With the conscientious precision of a railroad man, in the moment when the hand of the clock ended the half hour, he signed his name to the order instructing the Comet to proceed with engine number 306, and transmitted the order to Winston Station. The station agent at Winston shuddered when he looked at the order, but he was not the man to defy authority. He told himself that the tunnel was not perhaps as dangerous as he thought. He told himself that the best policy these days was not to think. When he handed their copies of the order to the conductor and the engineer of the Comet, the conductor glanced slowly about the room from face to face, folded the slip of paper, put it into his pocket, and walked out without a word. The engineer stood looking at the paper for a moment, then threw it down and said, "I'm not going to do it. And if it's come to where this railroad hands out orders like this one, I'm not going to work for it either. Just list me as having quit."
"But you can't quit," cried the station agent. "They'll arrest you for it."
"If they find me," said the engineer, and walked out of the station into the vast darkness of the mountain night. The engineer from Silver Springs, who had brought in number 306, was sitting in a corner of the room. He chuckled and said, "He's yellow." The station agent turned to him. "Will you do it, Joe? Will you take the Comet?" Joe Scott was drunk. There had been a time when a railroad man reporting for duty with any sign of intoxication would have been regarded as a doctor arriving for work with sores of smallpox on his face. But Joe Scott was a privileged person. 3 months ago, he had been fired for an infraction of safety rules, which had caused a major wreck. 2 weeks ago, he had been reinstated in his job by order of the Unification Board. He was a friend of Fred Kinnon. He protected Kinnon's interests in his union, not against the employers, but against the membership.
"Sure," said Joe Scott. "I'll take the Comet. I'll get her through if I go fast enough."
The fireman of number 306 had remained in the cab of his engine. He looked up uneasily when they came to switch his engine to the head end of the Comet. He looked up at the red and green lights of the tunnel, hanging in the distance above 20 miles of curves. But he was a placid, amiable fellow, who made a good fireman, with no hope of ever rising to engineer. His husky muscles were his only asset. He felt certain that his superiors knew what they were doing, so he did not venture any questions. The conductor stood by the rear end of the Comet. He looked at the lights of the tunnel, then at the long chain of the Comet's windows. A few windows were lighted, but most of them showed only the feeble blue glow of night lamps edging the lowered blinds. He thought that he should rouse the passengers and warn them. There had been a time when he had placed the safety of the passengers above his own, not by reason of love for his fellow men, but because that responsibility was part of his job, which he accepted and felt pride in fulfilling. Now he felt a contemptuous indifference and no desire to save them. They had asked for and accepted Directive 10-289, he thought. They went on living, and daily turning away in evasion from the kind of verdicts that the Unification Board was passing on defenseless victims. Why shouldn't he now turn away from them? If he saved their lives, not one of them would come forward to defend him when the Unification Board would convict him for disobeying orders, for creating a panic, for delaying Mr. Chalmers. He had no desire to be a martyr for the sake of allowing people safely to indulge in their own irresponsible evil. When the moment came, he raised his lantern and signaled the engineer to start. "See," said Kip Chalmers triumphantly to Lester Tuck, as the wheels under their feet shuddered forward. "Fear is the only practical means to deal with people." The conductor stepped onto the vestibule of the last car. No one saw him as he went down the steps of the other side, slipped off the train, and vanished into the darkness of the mountains. A switchman stood ready to throw the switch that would send the Comet from the siding onto the main track. He looked at the Comet as it came slowly toward him. It was only a blazing white globe with a beam stretching high above his head, and a jerky thunder trembling through the rail under his feet. He knew that the switch should not be thrown. He thought of the night 10 years ago, when he had risked his life in a flood to save a train from a washout. But he knew that times had changed. In the moment when he threw the switch and saw the headlight jerk sidewise, he knew that he would now hate his job for the rest of his life. The Comet uncoiled from the siding into a thin, straight line, and went on into the mountains with the beam of the headlight like an extended arm pointing the way, and the lighted glass curve of the observation lounge ending it off. Some of the passengers aboard the Comet were awake. As the train started its coiling ascent, they saw the small cluster of Winston's lights at the bottom of the darkness beyond their windows. Then the same darkness, but with red and green lights by the hole of a tunnel on the upper edge of the window panes. The lights of Winston kept growing smaller each time they appeared. The black hole of the tunnel kept growing larger. A black veil went streaking past the windows at times, dimming the lights. It was the heavy smoke from the coal-burning engine. As the tunnel came closer, they saw at the edge of the sky, far to the south, in a void of space and rock, a spot of living fire twisting in the wind. They did not know what it was, and did not care to learn. It is said that catastrophes are a matter of pure chance, and there were those who would have said that the passengers of the Comet were not guilty or responsible for the thing that happened to them. The man in bedroom A, car number 1, was a professor of sociology, who taught that individual ability is of no consequence, that individual effort is futile, that an individual conscience is a useless luxury, that there is no individual mind or character or achievement, that everything is achieved collectively, and that it's masses that count, not men. The man in roomette 7, car number 2, was a journalist, who wrote that it is proper and moral to use compulsion for a good cause, who believed that he had the right to unleash physical force upon others, to wreck lives, throttle ambitions, strangle desires, violate convictions, to imprison, to despoil, to murder, for the sake of whatever he chose to consider as his own idea of a good cause, which did not even have to be an idea, since he had never defined what he regarded as the good, but had merely stated that he went by a feeling unrestrained by any knowledge, since he considered emotion superior to knowledge, and relied solely on his own good intentions and on the power of a gun. The woman in roomette 10, car number 3, was an elderly school teacher who had spent her life turning class after class of helpless children into miserable cowards by teaching them that the will of the majority is the only standard of good and evil, that a majority may do anything it pleases, that they must not assert their own personalities but must do as others were doing. The man in drawing room B, car number 4, was a newspaper publisher who believed that men are evil by nature and unfit for freedom, that their basic interests, if left unchecked, are to lie, to rob, and to murder one another, and therefore men must be ruled by means of lies, robbery, and murder, which must be made the exclusive privilege of the rulers, for the purpose of forcing men to work, teaching them to be moral, and keeping them within the bounds of order and justice. The man in bedroom H, car number 5, was a businessman who had acquired his business, an ore mine, with the help of a government loan under the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. The man in drawing room A, car number 6, was a financier who had made a fortune by buying frozen railroad bonds and getting his friends in Washington to defreeze them. The man in seat 5, car number 7, was a worker who believed that he had a right to a job whether his employer wanted him or not. The woman in roomette 6, car number 8, was a lecturer who believed that as a consumer she had a right to transportation, whether the railroad people wished to provide it or not. The man in roomette 2, car number 9, was a professor of economics who advocated the abolition of private property, explaining that intelligence plays no part in industrial production, that man's mind is conditioned by material tools, that anybody can run a factory or a railroad, and it's only a matter of seizing the machinery. The woman in bedroom D, car number 10, was a mother who had put her 2 children to sleep in the berth above her, carefully tucking them in, protecting them from drafts and jolts. A mother whose husband held a government job enforcing directives, which she defended by saying, "I don't care, it's only the rich that they hurt. After all, I must think of my children." The man in room at 3, car number 11, was a sniveling little neurotic who wrote cheap little plays, into which, as a social message, he inserted cowardly little obscenities, to the effect that all businessmen were scoundrels. The woman in roomette 9, car number 12, was a housewife who believed that she had the right to elect politicians, of whom she knew nothing, to control giant industries, of which she had no knowledge. The man in bedroom F, car number 13, was a lawyer who had said, "Me? I'll find a way to get along under any political system." The man in bedroom A, car number 14, was a professor of philosophy who taught that there is no mind. "How do you know that the tunnel is dangerous?" No reality. How can you prove that the tunnel exists? No logic. Why do you claim that trains cannot move without motive power? No principles. Why should you be bound by the law of cause and effect? No rights. Why shouldn't you attach men to their jobs by force? No morality. What's moral about running a railroad? No absolutes. What difference does it make to you whether you live or die anyway? He taught that we know nothing. Why oppose the orders of your superiors? That we can never be certain of anything? How do you know you're right? That we must act on the expediency of the moment. You don't want to risk your job, do you? The man in drawing room B, car number 15, was an heir who had inherited his fortune and who had kept repeating, "Why should Reardon be the only one permitted to manufacture Reardon metal?" The man in bedroom A, car number 16, was a humanitarian who had said, "The men of ability? I do not care what or if they are made to suffer. They must be penalized in order to support the incompetent. Frankly, I do not care whether this is just or not. I take pride in not caring to grant any justice to the able, where mercy to the needy is concerned." These passengers were awake. There was not a man aboard the train who did not share one or more of their ideas. As the train went into the tunnel, the flame of Wyatt's torch was the last thing they saw on earth.